people often think that reason and imagination are opposed to each other, that you've got reason over here and you've got imagination over here. Here are the rational, hard-headed scientists, mathematical people, logical thinkers. And over here you've got the artists, the dreamy, wish-fulfillment, poetic, tender-hearted people, and never the twain shall meet. That's not how Lewis understands reason and imagination. They're not arranged like that. They are, in fact, arranged like that. Reason rests upon imagination. Reason can't work without imagination. Imagination supplies reason with the things that it can reason about. So all science, all mathematics, all logical inquiry is necessarily imaginative. That's Lewis's understanding of how the two faculties are related. We concluded the first part of this lecture with that very important quotation from Myth Became Fact. Let's just remind ourselves what Lewis said there before we launch into part two. He said, "I suspect that men have sometimes derived more spiritual sustenance from myths they did not believe than from the religion they professed. To be truly Christian, we must both assent to the historical fact and also receive the myth, fact though it has become, with the same imaginative embrace which we accord to all myths. The one is hardly more important than the other." The one is hardly more important than the other. The imaginative embrace is hardly more important than the historical fact, than assent to the historical fact, and vice versa. It's not possible to separate the imaginative embrace from the rational assent, because, as we have seen, reason depends upon imagination. But it's occasionally worth asking yourself which of them you would prefer if, at the point of a gun, you were forced to choose between them. It's quite a helpful thought experiment. And there's little doubt which Lewis would have inclined towards. He says this: "A man who disbelieved the Christian story as fact, but continually fed upon it as myth, would perhaps be more spiritually alive than one who assented and didn't think much about it." So, given that an imaginative embrace of Christianity is as necessary a response as rational assent, and given that rational assent can't be accorded without imaginative content informing it, the only issue that the apologist has to settle is whether he's going to conduct his reasoned defences in terms which are more imaginative or less imaginative. They're going to be imaginative at some level, whether he likes it or not. The question to be answered is, to what extent will the apologetic approach approximate the lived language of Jesus Christ, and to what extent will the apologetic approach render that language in more abstract categories? Abstract categories have the value of clarity, but in other respects they are less desirable, Lewis suggests. The less story-like the terms in which the apologist couches his argument, the less they can actually communicate the thing under discussion, because the thing under discussion is indeed a story. A factual story, but a story nonetheless, a sequence of events, with characters, with places. In a brilliant, though sadly incomplete, article entitled "The Language of Religion," Lewis homes in on this problem. He says this: "Apologetics is controversy. You cannot conduct a controversy in those poetical expressions which alone convey the concrete. You must use terms as definable and univocal as possible, and these are always abstract. And this means that the thing we're really talking about can never appear in the discussion at all. We have to try to prove that God is, in circumstances where we are denied every means of conveying who God is. We've already seen how Lewis discovered, in the course of his own path to faith, that doctrinal language is less adequate to the reality of Christian truth than the lived language of the Christ story itself. As an apologist, he further discovered that controversial language, the language of debate, the language of persuasion, the language of demonstration, that kind of language was even less adequate than the doctrinal language. Because in a controversy, you have to thin down your language so that you can communicate with your opponents, who by definition don't possess the imaginative embrace of the topic in hand necessary to a full appreciation of what you're saying. The apologist has to work, you might say, at the university lecture podium or at the bar of the courtroom, all the while talking about something which goes on in reality chiefly at neither place, but rather in prayer, in communion, in confession, in the reading of the scriptures, in service of the needy, in the holistic life of faith. That's what the apologist is trying to communicate. But apologetic language, the language of controversy, unavoidably uses a different kind of language, the language of the logic, as Lewis puts it, of speculative thought, instead of the more pertinent logic of personal relations. Apologetic language has to be univocal, so that it's useful in contexts where Christianity does not of its own nature normally reside. The situation is somewhat akin to Mozart or Beethoven trying to prove their musicality not by conducting one of their symphonies in front of an orchestra, but by standing gagged at a math blackboard using only numbers. And this is what Lewis means when he talks about the great disadvantages under which the Christian apologist labours. What are these disadvantages? The disadvantages are that what you're talking about is not easily communicable in typical language of controversy or controversy. The life of faith is best communicated in its own terms, namely life, the lived language of real human beings in real times in real places. Actions speak louder than words. If Christianity has to be turned into apologetic words, it's best to use words that tell a story, as in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Or perhaps even better, words that both tell a story and are richly resonant and connotative, like the mighty nouns of John's Gospel. Word, light, life, way, water, glory, vine, bread. Those narrative and symbolic terms are much more capacious than the attenuated metaphors characteristic of abstract arguments. And those terms are therefore more able to contain the huge wealth of meaning that there is to carry. Lewis was well aware of the disadvantages of abstraction, and therefore he did not limit himself to merely reasoned defences, those propositional and argumentative approaches of traditional apologetics. He also attempted much more poetic and creative presentations of the faith in his fiction. His most notable attempt was, of course, the Seven Chronicles of Narnia, and these stories have achieved more, perhaps, than any of his writings by way of communicating the heart of his faith. Rowan Williams has said of the Narnia Septet that more theological students ought to read it for a sense of what classical orthodox theology feels like from the inside, a unique achievement at that level. Chad Walsh, author of the first study of C.S. Lewis, Apostle to the Skeptics, is of a very similar opinion. He says that in these books, the Narnia Chronicles, where his imagination has full scope, Lewis presents the Christian faith in a more eloquent and probing way than ever his more straightforward books of apologetics could. But this present lecture is about apologetics in the sense of reasoned defences, where language can't be as rich and redolent and therefore true to life as in a fairy tale. In non-fiction apologetics, language has to be univocal, or at any rate, as Lewis puts it, as univocal as possible. Lewis didn't think it was possible to be completely univocal, even in his reasoned defences. For he believed that all language, except for the most basic and elementary, was metaphorical. And even the simplest metaphors are not merely verbal algebra. You can't turn Christianity into an equation. So Lewis makes a virtue of necessity. If you've got to be metaphorical, well then rejoice in metaphor. And if you compare Lewis's Mere Christianity with other broad introductory apologetic works, such as John Stott's Basic Christianity, or N.T. Wright's Simply Christian, or Tim Keller's The Reason for God, you notice how much Lewis's book stands out for the wealth of imagery and metaphor that it employs. He constantly resorts to analogy, to simile, to metaphor, in a way and to an extent which none of those three successor books that I just mentioned does. Talking of Mere Christianity, you will recall that flotilla metaphor. Human race is like a series of boats going out to sea. That's always struck me as especially helpful. Likewise, the image of the statues in the sculptor's shop. Other images, such as the White Smiles toothpaste, are rather past their sell-by date now, if you ask me. And the famous poached egg metaphor is perhaps also a little bit too colourful for its own good. But Lewis's working principle is certainly very sound, whatever the particular faults one may identify in his practice. Apologetic language benefits from being vivid, sensory, and chosen with poetic, not just abstractly rational, intent. Lewis then aims to lead his readers along the road he himself trod, as we have seen. Apprehension of meaningfulness was the first step in his conversion. And so it becomes, in due course, the customary first step in his apologetic method, even in his non-fiction. If you look at the rhetorical strategies informing Lewis's apologetics, you almost always find that he begins in the very first paragraph by immersing the reader in a meaningful situation. In Mere Christianity, it's quarrelling. Let me sit in that seat. I was there first. Give me a bit of orange. I gave you a bit of mine. That kind of quarrelling in Mere Christianity, or despairing in The Problem of Pain, or doubting in Miracles. In The Four Loves, when Lewis introduces the first of the loves, Storge, he aims, first of all, he says, to establish the meaning of the word. Storge meaning affection. But he says the image we must start with is that of a mother nursing a baby, a bitch or a cat with a basketful of puppies or kittens, all in a squeaking, nuzzling heap together. Purrings, lickings, baby talk, milk, warmth, the smell of young life. The method is poetic rather than polemic. There's no question at the outset of whether these images are, or situations are good or bad, true or false, beautiful or ugly. They just are. Rational judgments about their value can wait. We know that they mean something, and they resonate with our experience of the world or our observations of the world. Having thus engaged our imaginations, Lewis can then proceed to his next step. But as he proceeds, he doesn't leave imagination behind and exit into a purely rational realm. His strategy is imaginative all the way along. It has to be, remember, given his understanding of how reason works. There's no question of discarding imagination and emerging into some neutral, reliable, mathematical, disinterested region which must perforce command the assent of all objective observers. Lewis isn't willing to reduce himself or his readers to mere thinkers, mere abstract thinkers, in a sort of ultra-Cartesian move which plagues so much inferior apologetics and so many earnest undergraduate late-night discussions. It's no good arguing for God or Christ or the atonement or even for truth until the apologist has shown, at least at some basic level, that these terms have meaning. Otherwise, they'll just be counters in an intellectual game, leaving most readers cold. Likewise, apologetic arguments for the authority of the church or of the Bible or of reason itself, they must all be imaginatively realized before they can begin to make traction on the reader's reason, let alone on the reader's will. Before we act or think, we understand meaning, in Lewis's view. And so the provision of meaningful images becomes the hallmark of his apologetic method. But although Lewis accords imagination a high place, it is not the only or the highest place. There is also reason. And reason is important, indeed essential, if imagination is to serve its proper purpose. Lewis distinguishes between two kinds of imagination, the bad and the good. The bad kind is what he calls the merely imaginary, but the good kind is the imaginative. Pagan myths, however meaningful, were ultimately untrustworthy as a final guide to life because their meanings were imaginary rather than imaginative. That's why Lewis is a Christian, not a pagan. Without the controlling and clarifying effects of reason, imaginative efforts at apprehending God are always apt to lose themselves and turn bad. In the Pilgrim's Regress, for instance, the pagans become corrupt in their imaginations, remember, because their imaginative pictures are not supplemented by the truthful rules of the shepherd people. In other words, the pagans don't have the clarifying effect of the law given to Moses. So their imaginations become merely imaginary. To prevent imagination going bad, it must be properly related to reason, and both imagination and reason properly related to the will. Sometimes Lewis pictures the human person as three concentric circles. The outermost circle is the imagination, then inside that comes the ring, comes the middle ring, the reason, and at the core is the will itself. Although imagination is the most exposed of those three rings and the one most naturally inclined to deceive, to go bad, it's nevertheless indispensable to the two higher rings, the two more central levels. Images provide reason and the will with the very stuff of conscious life. Lewis says, "I doubt if any act of will or thought or emotion occurs in me without images." So imagination, which is good, serves reason, which is better, and both serve the will, which is best of all. The good serves the better, and both serve the best. One of the reasons, I think, why Lewis has become so popular as an apologist, why some of his passages from his apologetics have become almost anthology pieces, is that his logical, his reasoned argumentation is informed by a sensitive poetic intelligence. His choice of image and metaphor and analogy is controlled by an alert imagination, and as a result, charges what he says with a pleasing appropriateness, even sometimes a superfluity of meaning. His apologetic writing at its best becomes rich and enjoyable for its own sake, almost regardless of whether you actually agree with the conclusions he arrives at. This carries its own dangers, of course, and Lewis's colleague, the theologian Austin Farrer, remarked, with respect to the problem of pain, that we think we're listening to an argument. In fact, we're presented with a vision, and it's the vision that carries conviction. But the dangerousness is an indication of the method's power. And when used aright, the vision doesn't overpower the argument, but supports it, and indeed enables it. Think, for instance, of the image of the great dive in Miracles as a picture of the Incarnation. That's a very fruitful and helpful passage. Or think of the myth of Lewis's own devising in the chapter on charity and the four loves. Also extremely helpful. Much more so than abstract argumentation would have been. And so, the good imagination serves the better reason, which allows readers to understand a good deal about their human situation and even a certain amount about God, but only a certain amount. We've already pointed out imagination's deficiencies. Reason is also deficient for the full knowledge of God. Reason, for Lewis, we must remember, was not the organ of truth, but the natural organ of truth. That adjective, natural, is crucial. Reason can't rise to the supernatural in its own strength. Lewis was a self-confessed rationalist, yes, but he believed in a great deal more than merely Enlightenment ratiocination. His understanding of reason was older, more broadly based than that. As far as he was concerned, reason depends not only on what we might call the ground floor, imagination, but also on the basement, physical sensation. Only then could reason be supplied with its raw materials. But considered alone, reason is nothing special. It's gnawing peasant reason, as the young Lewis calls it in an early poem. Reason is helpless unless equipped by imagination, and indeed by sensation. And even thus equipped, it can't reach into the heavens. We can't save ourselves. To his friend Harwood, Lewis wrote this in 1926, "No one is more convinced than I that reason is utterly inadequate to the richness and spirituality of real things. Indeed, this is itself a deliverance of reason." And he never turned away from that position, as many of his later writings, most notably Till We Have Faces, demonstrate. So Lewis's religion, Lewis's Christianity, is not merely rational any more than it is merely imaginative. But it would be a mistake to conclude that his Christianity was composed merely of an imaginatively informed rationality. It's even more than that. Imagination and reason together work not to serve themselves, but to serve the will. The good serves the better and both the best. The best is the will, the heart of the person. And this requires to be reoriented by a meeting with the divine. However much an apologist may labour with imaginative skill and with rational intent to defend the faith and persuade sceptics, nothing can be achieved, Lewis says, without the intervention of the supernatural. Because only the supernatural can bring about an alteration of the will. How then can a Christian apologist hope for supernatural intervention in this imaginatively rational process of Christian apologetics? Well, I think there are two main ways by which the supernatural may intervene in the situation. And one method of supernatural revelation is, oddly enough, by means of natural revelation. We mustn't put God and nature into a zero-sum game. The creative word of God sustains the natural virtues, Lewis says in a letter of 1940. And those natural virtues include the good use of imagination, no less than the good use of reason, however fallen reason and imagination may be. Because, remember, God is the Father of lights. The divine light enlightens all human minds, not just those which are already Christian. So that certain examples of imaginative perception, Lewis argues, can be said to be real approaches, however rudimentary, to the idea of God. And indeed, approaches that operate beyond our own resources. Imagination, like all created things, including reason, properly understood, reflects something of its creator. It's this sort of imagination which Lewis told T.S. Eliot he believed in as a truth-bearing faculty. To think otherwise would be to embrace the negative theology, that excessively apophatic theology, of which Lewis, with his deep-seated belief in natural law, disapproved. "I am inclined," he wrote, "to distrust that species of respect for the spiritual order which bases itself on contempt for the natural order. The natural exercise of imaginative reason may, up to a point, be a revelation of the supernatural, and therefore an intervention by the supernatural. God works through the things he has made." However, there is another way too. The rationally imaginative explanations of Christianity that the apologist provides, and which are indeed supported by the divine, can only take one so far. And it is at the point where they fall short that the divine intervention already seen in the exercise of natural faculties may be supplemented by divine supervention. The internal presence of God in the human subject may meet the external presence of God in the Holy Spirit's direct illumination, or as it may be mediated through the more normal channels of Christian life, through preaching, sacrament, scripture, prayer, fasting, and other forms of spiritual and devotional practice. So the Christian apologist is a kind of John the Baptist figure, preparing the way for the one who comes after. Apologetics serves a vital ancillary function. And this is its main justification. For although reasoned defences don't of themselves create conviction, the absence of them makes belief much harder to engender or sustain. Again, Austin Farrer, Lewis's friend, wrote this, talking of Lewis's apologetic strategy: "What seems to be proved may not be embraced, but what no one shows the ability to defend is quickly abandoned. Rational argument does not create belief, but it maintains a climate in which belief may flourish. So the apologist who does nothing but defend may play a useful, though preparatory, part." Thus Austin Farrer. But all this talk of divine supervention takes us away from the field of pure apologetics into fields of evangelism and soteriology. The indispensable role that Lewis found for divinely imparted faith, both in the acquisition of Christian belief and in the retention of Christian belief, is not something I can here get into, though the subject is certainly worth exploring. Let me therefore conclude with what Lewis wrote in The Decline of Religion. He says this: "Conversion requires an alteration of the will, and an alteration which, in the last resort, does not occur without the intervention of the supernatural. I do not in the least agree with those who therefore conclude that the spread of an intellectual and imaginative climate favourable to Christianity is useless. You do not prove munition workers useless by showing that they cannot themselves win battles, however proper this reminder would be if they attempted to claim the honour due to fighting men. If the intellectual climate is such that when a man comes to the crisis at which he must either accept or reject Christ, his reason and imagination are not on the wrong side, then his conflict will be fought out under favourable conditions. And this, I think, is a good summary of what Lewis is trying to achieve as a Christian apologist. He's trying to provide favorable conditions, both rationally and imaginatively, within which that critical moment of conversion, that moment at which the will must be altered, can come about more easily.